This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, November 18th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. On November 12th, Britney Spears was released from the conservatorship that had overseen her finances, communications, and professional and personal life for more than 13 years. Conservatorships are often put in place to manage the affairs of the elderly or infirm, but Spears in that time has released albums, played a world tour, and headlined a four-year residency in Las Vegas. The details of the conservatorship were shrouded in mystery and poorly covered by the media, the same media that had once documented Spears' every move. Over the past 2 years, things started to change. The Free Britney movement, as it had come to be known, increasingly advocated for her autonomy, publicizing such restrictions as Spears' inability to choose her own legal representation. Journalists and documentarians began to look into these abuses and chronicled Spears' attempts to get out from under the conservatorship's control. On Tuesday evening, in a video on Instagram, Spears credited the Free Britney movement with helping her gain her freedom.
And the Free Britney movement, you guys rock. Honestly, my voice was muted and threatened for so long, and I wasn't able to speak up or say anything. And because of you guys and the awareness of kind of knowing what was going on and delivering that news to the public for so long, you gave it awareness to all of them. And because of you, I honestly think you guys saved my life in a way, 100%.
Gia Tolentino, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss how Spears' conservatorship finally came to an end, how the media shaped her professional and personal life, and the role of online movements in affecting change. Hi, Gia. Welcome back to the program. It's so good to see you again.
Hi, Dorothy. It's great to be back.
So this July, you and Ronan Farrow wrote a deeply reported piece about how Spears, at age 26, became ensnared in the conservatorship. Remind us how her father, along with a string of other conservators, came to take control of virtually every aspect of her life.
So I think many people remember the period in late 2007, early 2008 that was spun in the media as Britney is crazy, right? She shaved her head in public. There was this horrific sort of paparazzi chase of her on the way to the hospital after an incident at her home. And one of the things that immediately came out in our reporting, you know, talking to dozens and dozens of people who had been close to her previous to that point or around that point, was that what was really going on was a child custody fight in a lot of ways. These incidents were directly precipitated by her being refused access to her kids, or there was more going on, I guess I'm saying, in those events than what it seemed. But her family was, by all accounts, legitimately concerned for their daughter. They hadn't been very close to her for some time, but they were trying to find a way, as many families do when you have a child in what might be a severe mental health episode or perhaps a substance use crisis, which they both of which they thought were possible. You know, what can you do to formally gain some control over an adult? And so one of the options was a conservatorship. It was a long shot because a probate conservatorship of the type Britney was under, this is intended for people that will not get better, people who have degenerative conditions, the very old, the severely disabled. It was seen, they thought it would be difficult to get Britney Spears under a conservatorship. And then they were able to, you know, you want to call it manipulate the situation into making that possible by calling, you know, calling the fire department on her. Or you could also say that events just happened so that a conservatorship was plausibly seen as warranted by a judge.
But there are a range of less draconian alternatives, such as conditional powers of attorney or formal shared control of finances, you know, without getting into all of the weeds on this stuff. Remind us just how restrictive Spears' arrangement was.
A probate conservatorship, you know, they vary person to person, but it can take away your right to get married, your right to vote, your right to drive, your right to seek employment. But in Britney's case, what it meant was that she was working very hard, working constantly, right? She was put under conservatorship in 2008. That same year, she put out what I think is her best album, Blackout. And she went on a tour that was one of the highest grossing tours of the year, this global tour. But still, she did not have control over who she saw. She had, as we found out in that New York Times documentary, controlling Britney Spears, they were surveilling her. Her security team was surveilling her in her bedroom. You know, she couldn't drive her own car. She couldn't sign her own contracts. She couldn't make her business decisions. She was told that, you know, sushi dinners were too expensive, some reporting has shown. You know, and meanwhile, she's making millions and millions of dollars and paying much of it to her conservators.
You're part of the generation that grew up with Britney Spears. What's your first memory of her?
I remember the burned CD that I slipped into a Discman when I heard Baby One More Time for the first time. And those opening beats, I'll never forget. I mean, she was everything and everywhere. She was the sun around which the whole solar system of bubblegum teen pop revolved. And she became very quickly this figure upon which so many broader cultural ideas of virtue and corruption and purity and, you know, an over-sexualization and, you know, and value and normative worth, you know, that was all built into Britney. That was all projected onto Britney at, you know, the age when most of us are just, you know, going to Sonic in high school, right? She was on TV as a teenager getting questioned about whether or not she had breast implants. And in a lot of ways, her story now, it's a continuation of that, right? The whole conservatorship saga is still a product. It came about because of this idea of what a woman like her should be and what she should be free to do and what she shouldn't and what we need her to do in public, which is continue to be blonde and perform and make lots of money for lots of other people and have a perfect body and also be a perfect mom. You know, her life has been constrained from, you know, for essentially the last three decades by these very, very specific ideas of what a girl and a woman should be.
Yeah, and it's even more complex than that in a way. I was really interested in your piece with Ronan, how you wrote about the Baby One More Time music video, which featured Britney at age 16 in a schoolgirl pleated skirt and a bare midriff, and that was an outfit she chose. So how do you think she understood her place in pop culture? Even at that age, she seemed to have been very savvy about her self-presentation, though, of course, unable to anticipate how she would be playing into the hands, ultimately, of those who came to torment her.
Yeah, right. Famously, you know, the famous schoolgirl outfit was Britney's idea. And being reminded of that during the reporting process, it reminded me of how complicated the link between sexuality and power is when you're a teenage girl, right? I remember myself having this unformed but very real awareness of a way that I could present myself that would make the world open up to me in many ways. And, you know, it's hard to watch her dance in those early music videos and not feel that sense of ownership that radiated from her, you know, as she was moving in her body. You know, and I think it's also true that there's no way to understand when you're 16 and 17 how that thing, which to you could feel like self-ownership and demonstrating these extraordinary abilities, you know, drawing people in just simply with your own charisma and talent, the context of that, the way that that is one gear in a much larger machine.
And maybe zero in on how her rise to fame coincided with the explosion of the internet and later social media. You know, celebrities have always been hounded by paparazzi and you know, prying journalists. What made being a celebrity in the 2000s different, aside from the fact that she was also very young at the time?
Well, Britney was this sort of, I guess, the problematic golden girl, right? Like, she had taken a vow of, you know, she had talked about her vow of purity till marriage, but was also getting questioned about her boobs and sort of shimmying around on stage everywhere. And then the public started to turn on her right when she and Justin Timberlake broke up. And that coincided with the rise of the sort of TMZ supermarket tabloid, Us Weekly, industry. And this was a time, you know, since the era of Britney, you know, and people talk about it, the Britney, Lindsay Lohan, Paris Hilton, they were the sort of trifecta of the, you know, the tabloid cover girls about whom the public spoke and behaved in ways that we now would find, you know, completely unacceptable. They were constantly upskirted, right, and made fun of it on the cover of tabloids. They, you know, paparazzi photos were selling for hundreds of thousands of dollars of them. And since that era, there are new, like the California vehicular code is different because of that era, because people remembered, you know, 20, 25 cars just speeding in the wrong direction down streets in LA to catch that shot of Britney. Like, it was the peak of this sort of sleazy, high-octane tabloid industry. And that is a part of her story. You know, that in many ways, I think, is maybe the primary reason for her so-called breakdown. You know, she had two kids within a year, and she was hounded everywhere she went with people that were eager to make six figures on a picture that could show that maybe she was a bad mother. I would have broken down, you know. I would have acted out in ways that might have been a lot worse than she did. And so you're right, the story of Britney is in a lot of ways the story of these sort of material media structures. And then the story of her getting free is in many ways a story of sort of a decentralized internet movement that is Free Britney.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
The seeds for the Free Britney movement, which has been leading the public opposition to her, this conservatorship, were planted in 2009, shortly after the conservatorship came into being. What about Free Britney's origins and its activism over the years?
Yeah, so Britney has this legendary fan base, right? This incredibly devoted fan army. And I think many people in that fan army were supportive of the conservatorship initially, because it did seem like she was in crisis and maybe this would help. And she did start performing again and all that kind of stuff. But the longer it took, you know, in 2009, it's already like, wait, you know, she went on this global tour. She released an album. Why is she still under this conservatorship? Why? And, you know, there were all these things that nobody could see that were going on that have come out in recent reporting. Like, she wasn't allowed an unmonitored phone, right? And there had been this idea of, like, we need to give her privacy, this well-meaning and sort of correct idea that Britney Spears deserves some privacy. I think many fans were reticent to criticize a situation that they didn't know about. But a few committed people were raising the flag, you know, why is she under this arrangement that is intended for, you know, 97-year-olds, you know, with severe dementia, right? And the longer she was under the conservatorship, the more absurd and the more unwarranted the structure started to seem. And, you know, the movement really reached another height in 2019 when there was a voicemail that was sent to the podcast Britney's Gram that sort of purported to be from a paralegal who had knowledge that she was being held against her will in a medical facility. This is a story that Britney herself corroborated in her testimony to the court. And starting at that point, once there was, you know, a purported voice from the inside saying, you know, Britney's trying to get out, people started looking for clues. People started combing through the paperwork and seeing these things like, you know, her dad had checked a box on the initial petition saying she had dementia. And then on future petitions, that box was never checked again. And it really is to the credit of the Free Britney movement that they did that. They dug in the case file. They posted these transcripts from these documents over and over in social media. They even assembled a timeline of events that made it, you know, kind of unignorable what had happened, the sort of legal machinations that had gone on to make this situation possible.
So that was when you and Ronan and these high-profile documentarians and other journalists began really digging into the story. It sounds like they provided the kind of groundwork.
Yeah, and the Times did an early piece, like I want to say maybe 2017, that was like, just a reminder, Britney Spears is under this incredibly bizarre legal arrangement that, for me, that was when I really started paying attention again myself.
How did she, if she did, advocate for herself in the midst of this maelstrom?
I think there's a really cruel and painful way in which a conservatorship can serve as a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? And this is something that I think happens very frequently for young adults with disabilities. You know, often young people coming out of the special education system will get conservatorship or guardianship, that's what it's called in most states, recommended to their parents as sort of, this is what you should do if you want to maintain sort of healthy control over this person's life. And I think once you're told formally that you are not capable of making decisions, that you are not really worthy of making mistakes, I would find that personally extremely hard not to internalize. And, you know, we found out that she had kept trying, you know. She had, the fact that she was able after 13 years of this to assert herself in public at what really feels like great risk, you know, that was remarkable to me.
So Free Britney does feel different from other online movements that have caught on around the world. It's almost never a good thing when you think about QAnon or January 6th, to say nothing of the many toxic fandoms that exist online. Mm-hmm. But so how different is Free Britney? I mean, are there other forums that have served this kind of purpose, or has it really kind of marked out some new ground?
Well, I'm sure, you know, though it's true that there is not a plethora of, you know, wholesome mass online movements that are springing to my mind right now, I think that one thing that has distinguished the Free Britney movement, and, you know, it's not to say there are conspiratorial corners of it. There is, you know, there are members of it that I think have engaged in sort of beehive type, you know, just sort of incredibly aggressive online commenting or whatever. I wouldn't want to say that the Free Britney movement is just completely like sunshine and rainbows and, you know, we support our queen and pink glitter, all that stuff. But one thing that I think is actually very deliberate on the part of the sort of de facto leaders of the movement, many of which are based in LA and are, you know, longtime diehard Britney fans, is that they've tried really hard to center the issue of disability rights in the conversation about it. They have consistently, I've been to a lot of virtual Free Britney rallies and meetings, and they bring in probate lawyers, they bring in people with experience with sort of estate litigation. I talk to a lot of Free Britney members, and many of them come at this from a point of view of, I too have experienced mental health issues, and I can't imagine what it would be like to have all of my rights as a person taken away as a result. And there's been sort of a concerted effort to keep that, if not at the center, somewhere near the forefront. And it has helped, I think. It's helped the movement stay on message. You know, the Free Britney is really about Britney, but members of the movement really try hard to say it's not about Britney. There are millions of people in guardianship, or I think the figure is 1.5 million people under guardianship. There's $273 billion in assets that are under guardianship, right? Like there's a lot of Britneys in the world.
Yeah, and a lot of times the money disappears, which I gather in Spears' case, it did not.
Well, I don't know if we can say that the money didn't disappear. You know, Britney is not destitute right now. She has the estate of the conservatorship shows that she's got $60 million in assets. But when you think about how long Britney Spears has been performing, $60 million doesn't seem that, you know, it's an amount of money that I can't personally imagine ever touching. But it seems like she's earned quite a bit more. And at the basic level, what we can see is that every year she has paid millions of dollars to her conservators and their lawyers and the management team hired by the conservators. And one of the features, the sort of Kafka-esque features of the conservatorship is Britney paid for the conservators to fight her wishes to get free. She paid for the defense of the conservatorship. And the harder she fought against it, the more lawyer hours they had to bill to fight her back. And she paid for every single one of those hours. And I think, you know, it is fundamentally about money. You know, one thing that gets brought up a lot, if it was this hard for Britney to get free with this many people watching and this much, you know, and her demonstrating her capacity in such an extraordinary way in public for so long, if it took this long for Britney to get free, you know, what would it take for an ordinary person to get free? And I think there's truth in that. But I also think it's worth remembering that it's because of her talent and the fact that she's just this living, seen as this living asset by many people. It's because of her wealth that she was conserved for so long. When people are having mental health crises or become severely disabled and they don't have money, you know, if there's nothing to exploit there, they're essentially discarded by society altogether in many cases.
It's interesting also what you say about the Free Britney movement and its focus on conservatorships in general. In Tuesday's video, Spears mentioned that she intended to advocate for people with real disabilities and real illnesses, as she put it, and that she hopes to help change a corrupt system. Mm-hmm. What do you think she will be able to do now to help other people living under conservatorships? And do you anticipate that this movement behind her will continue to channel its energy into that mission?
So the thing about, like, you know, the thing about Britney, it's a sparkly and sexy and riveting case, right? Many cases are not like this, right? Many cases don't have the glitzy, you know, the sort of Hollywood underbelly sort of tone of the coverage that makes essentially a story about the probate court system, which is not so sexy absent Britney. You know, it has really helped draw attention to this. But I do think, you know, if Britney were to become a prominent advocate for conservatorship reform, there is a lot to be done there. You know, we've seen it, even politicians have started signing on to legislation for just like the formal right to independent counsel, which isn't guaranteed in every state, right? There's no centralized database of conservatorships in many states. There's no avenues. If we wanted to establish more oversight over conservatorships, there's not even, states don't even keep track of conservatorships. They don't, it's like 60% of courts don't review the credit histories of potential guardians. Like 40% don't even conduct a criminal background check. Mm. There are so many things that can be reformed. You know, there's a lot that could be done.
You and Ronan wrote in another piece last week, Spears is still in a profoundly difficult position, despite and perhaps because of her new control of her life. If she acts in any way that could be construed as irresponsible, it could be taken in legal battles to come, you say, as proof that she can't handle her own life. So it strikes me that this might also be true about the public. Mm-hmm. Online movements are fickle. If Spears does something that the media or her online community finds objectionable, do you think these people will stick with her?
I do think that the Free Britney movement will stick with her. The media at large, you know, who knows? But I think that one thing that has seemed quite clear to me in my conversations with and, you know, eavesdropping on the Free Britney rallies and such is that the movement grasps very clearly that it's part of life. It's part of being a human. It's part of being an adult, that you make mistakes and you learn from those mistakes and you make better choices next time, right? That the standard that Britney is held to under conservatorship is that everything that she does must be within her best interest, as determined by someone else, right? And as determined, in her case, by someone that's making a huge amount of money off of her. And it's like in real life, you know, we don't operate in our own best interests oftentimes. We often try to, but the way that we actually learn to do it is by making terrible mistakes. It's like with many people, let's say you end up underwater on a house because you signed a really bad mortgage, you made a bad financial decision. If we don't have a disability, that's not seen as proof that we need to, like, yikes, maybe we got to take away that person's ability to ever sign like a binding legal contract again. Most of us are allowed to make terrible mistakes and live with them. Disability rights advocates talk about the dignity of risk. And Britney has not been allowed that for a huge portion of her adult life. I mean, even arguably before the conservatorship. And it would be really hard after 13 years of being formally disempowered, suddenly being handed control over your life with the whole world watching. That is not a position that any of us would envy. Like, I'm so glad that she has the basic legal rights back that all of us avail ourselves of every day. But she herself wrote in an Instagram caption, I think a couple months back, she was like, I'm afraid. The paparazzi are still chasing me. I'm afraid of making a mistake. The business of watching Britney Spears mess up has been enormously profitable for a large amount of people in the past. And the desire we have to watch celebrities make mistakes and sort of melt down, it's not like what it was in 2004, but it hasn't gone away.
She is still totally enmeshed with the press. That's just inevitable. We're discussing it on a podcast right now. So in a sense, one problem in Britney's life has been addressed, but a bigger one persists. And do you think she can change the public image of her in part through the work she intends to be doing in coming months and years?
You know, if I was Britney, I would want to like never see a news camera again in my life, right? But at the same time, she also knows that, you know, she was talking about wanting to go on Oprah, right? I think she herself understands her entanglement with the press and the fact that, you know, if she is to make a real statement and sort of expose what she says are effectively criminal misdeeds by her family, she will probably do this through like a media institution. I will say that I think that the coverage of Britney over the last few years has been, by and large, quite respectful. Like, I think the documentaries have been respectful. I think that the continued reporting has not been salacious, right? It's not. And I think that the terms have changed, right? I mean, the way that we speak about mental health right now is much more careful and respectful than the way we talked about it in 2002, which was basically we didn't talk about it at all. I mean, it was one thing that we heard over and over in the reporting was that no one ever brought up to Britney Spears that she could have been dealing with severe postpartum depression, right? And that's kind of unimaginable now. And so I do think the terms of engagement, the terms of the discourse are radically different. While at the same time, I'm sure the media it will always be this ambivalent, you know, in many ways corrosive force, even as it is the thing that has, you know, it's given her this power and it's taken it away too.
And with that, we will stop talking about Spears. Thank you so much, Gia.
Thank you, Dorothy.
Gia Tolentino, a staff writer at The New Yorker, is the author of Trick Mirror. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. We're off next week. Happy Thanksgiving. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.